and welcome to the ESVS podcast. This is Susanne Stockmans, and you are listening to part three of the Q&A series of the 2025 ESVS Clinical Practice Guidelines on the Management of Diseases of the Mesenteric and Renal Arteries and Veins. In this podcast, we will highlight the new, complex, and most controversial recommendations in this guideline. On today's episode, we will dive deeper into mesenteric venous thrombosis, renal vascular diseases, and visceral artery dissections. Welcome again, Dr. Koelemeij, Professor Geelkerke, and Dr. Leone, and thank you for joining us on the second episode.
Hi, hello everybody. Hello.
Acute mesenteric venous thrombosis is the least common cause of acute mesenteric ischemia. It's typically defined as thrombosis of the superior mesenteric vein with or without extension into the portal or splenic veins. This can lead to venous mesenteric ischemia, which is rare and often triggered by either transient or permanent risk factors, similar to other forms of venous thrombosis, such as malignancy, trauma, or hormonal therapy. Interestingly, in 20 to 30% of patients, no underlying cause can be identified. As with arterial mesenteric ischemia, mesenteric venous thrombosis can present in both acute and chronic forms. Could you elaborate on the main differences between acute and chronic mesenteric venous thrombosis and how these patients typically present in clinical practice?
Well, when we discussed venous mesenteric thrombosis, we actually realized that patients will not be suspected of venous thrombosis. And when they come to the emergency department, they will typically present with pain, anorexia, probably diarrhea. When the physician wants to have a more accurate diagnosis, they will make either an ultra-abdominal sonography or a CT scan. And then on the CT scan, it will be obvious that there's a venous mesenteric thrombosis. So in fact, in the acute phase, it is characterized by pain, malaise, anorexia, not feeling well, and then you have a diagnosis. And in the chronic form, which is arbitrarily after 4 weeks, symptoms will probably reside and the patient will develop collaterals because of portal hypertension. And in this way, the chronic mesenteric thrombosis can be recognized.
Do you think that really acute mesenteric venous thrombosis really exists? We know in the arterial form, an acute embolism in the SMA, at that moment, the ischemia is starting and the symptoms are starting. But in my experience, in mesenteric venous thrombosis, the symptoms are developing in days or mostly weeks. So really acute, normal venous outflow, and at that moment it will be thrombosed, I think it does not exist. What is your comment on this hypothesis?
Well, you're trying to get philosophical already. And I must admit that I haven't given it this deep thought. I think, though, there is some kind of acute venous mesenteric thrombosis because the patient may come with acute symptoms. These are the patients in whom it is considered to do thrombolysis.
It's relatively rare. So nobody has a huge experience with acute mesenteric venous thrombosis patients. But in my experience, if we talk to these patients, nearby all have gradually developing symptoms and not this afternoon at 3 o'clock, it's starting. That's not the case in venous thrombosis.
It's an interesting thought, actually, because development of mesenteric thrombosis, it's not acute. Patient will be admitted, will be observed, and then symptoms will subside or the patient will deteriorate. So there's not an acute moment of acute ischemia with a dead bowel that you have to take out or have to revascularize. It's interesting why in one person this will lead to congestion and then in the end the need for bowel resection. Whilst in the other patient, there's a really mild development, a mild course of the disease, actually.
And in arterial forms of mesenteric ischemia, there is not much evidence and there's a lot of discussion. In the most rare cause of acute mesenteric ischemia, the venous form, there's even no evidence at all. So it's all personal opinion and personal thoughts. Maybe the clinical presentation can be acute, but I can't imagine there is an acute thrombosis. So the thrombosis developed gradually, and one moment you get symptoms. There isn't a moment the patient come to the doctor. Some patients came to the doctor with a completely developed mesenteric venous thrombosis. And in that moment, the ball could be at risk, but also in my experience, it has the best prognosis of all kind of mesenteric ischemias.
So it's good to realize that there is a thrombosis present, which not necessarily leads to ischemia of the bowel, whereas most often when it's on the arterial side, a thrombosis or embolism will lead to mesenteric ischemia.
Recommendation 49, class 1, level C advises using contrast-enhanced CT, including arterial and portal venous phases for patients suspected of mesenteric vein thrombosis. What are the characteristic CT features you assess in these patients? And how reliable is CT in distinguishing acute from chronic mesenteric venous ischemia?
I think duplex is not accurate to diagnose venous thrombosis. Two reasons. It can be in the small vessels, and you can't imagine them as duplex. And the second reason, in most of these cases, the bowel is distended. There's a lot of air inside the bowel. And at that moment, duplex is not the appropriate technique. First, second, and third choice is CT scanning. And then you must assess the venous part itself. It means the superior mesenteric vein, the splenic vein, and in the end, the portal vein, the drain of the bowel. Everything what's happened in the bowel is transported to the portal vein. And you have to assess them accurately. That's the most easy part. But you also have to assess more non-vascular findings, like bowel wall thickening, bowel wall dilatation, bowel wall thinning, mesenteric fat stranding, pneumatosis, portovenous gas. These are all criteria for severe ischemia, but none of them is proven transmural necrosis. That's the difficulty of CT scanning. And performing CT scanning is like in the arterial phase. It should be a contrast-enhanced CT with arterial and venous phase. And then, if you expected the venous thrombosis, please also perform the venous phase in 1 millimeter slices.
Due to the rarity of mesenteric venous thrombosis and the limited high-quality evidence, there is no universally agreed-upon treatment strategy. The main objective in acute mesenteric venous thrombosis are to prevent thrombus propagation, restore venous patency, and avoid bowel infarction, portal hypertension, and recurrent thrombosis. In chronic cases, treatment also focuses on preventing and managing complications such as gastrointestinal bleeding and portal cholangiopathy. First-line therapy is systemic anticoagulation, which achieves venous recanalization in approximately 40 to 80% of patients. Supportive care, including pain management, fluid and electrolyte replacement, and bowel rest, should be initiated promptly. The new recommendation 51, Class 2B Level C, suggests that endovascular venous thrombolysis or mechanical thrombectomy can be considered in patients with acute venous mesenteric ischemia who deteriorate despite anticoagulation. Could you elaborate on the different endovascular treatment options available and whether there's still a role for surgical treatment in these cases?
We are talking about the most rare cause of mesenteric ischemia, and here we are talking about a small portion of patients not responding to anticoagulants. The new recommendation for endovascular therapy focuses on directly treating the massive clot burden and rapidly restoring blood flow. However, these are used in a very small percentage of people, and the available endovascular options are catheter-directed thrombolysis, mechanical thrombectomy, and a combination pharmacomechanical thrombectomy. These procedures are minimally invasive and are performed via percutaneous access, most commonly through transhepatic or transjugular approach into the portal system. The essential role of surgery is to manage the life-threatening complication of MVT, namely the bowel infarction. And so, personally, I don't see a modern role for open vascular surgery to remove clots in these districts. And I do think that procedures should be performed in selected centers that have the numbers to reach the learning curve in these procedures. I do think that in these cases, centralization is mandatory.
The evidence for catheter-based interventions for this is very poor. We used a systematic review, including nearly 500 patients, and these were uncontrolled series. So, in fact, there's no control with anticoagulation, no head-to-head comparison at least, and we cannot be sure whether this is actually more beneficial than anticoagulation. The flowchart shows that if a patient does not improve on anticoagulation, you may consider doing an endovascular treatment. I agree that experience with this is very limited, also in our academic hospital and probably also in your institution. And you might have a say to centralize interventions for this because of the rarity.
Well, thank you for this clarification. We already talked a little bit about heparinization after the initial phase of systemic anticoagulation. Oral anticoagulation is typically started within 2 to 3 weeks. Traditional vitamin K antagonists were the drugs of choice, but small retrospective studies now suggest that direct oral anticoagulations, or DOACs, are also safe, reflected in a new recommendation 53, Class 2B, Level C. Patients are generally treated for 3 to 6 months, although the optimal duration of anticoagulation remains uncertain. Recommendation 54, class 2A level C, and 55, class 2B level C, state that extended anticoagulation with either vitamin K antagonist or DOACs should or may be considered for patients with acute mesenteric vein thrombosis who have transient risk factors for venous thrombosis. Given the limited evidence, how do you decide on the duration and type of anticoagulation in your clinical practice? And do you see DOACs becoming the preferred option over vitamin K antagonist in these patients?
Well, in fact, this is a touchy area for surgeons because venous mesenteric thrombosis is mainly the domain of internal medicine, also because of the underlying causes for venous mesenteric thrombosis. In fact, surgeons, at least in our hospital, are not in charge for the definitive treatment of these patients. And the experience with DOACs is limited. So in fact, we decided to make a disclaimer in this guideline to recommend DOACs as a 2A, but as a 2B. You might consider this as off-label because it has not been investigated for venous mesenteric thrombosis. And the internist cannot give you the definitive answer either. I think that in the future, when there's more experience with DOACs, it seems logical that these will take over because it's easier to dose. There's no need for checks. But this is why it's quite safe recommendation for DOACs to use. And then your question about extensive use, this is interesting because from the internal medicine systematic reviews and meta-analyses, it became obvious that continued anticoagulation was in fact beneficial. So when patients discontinued treatment, they had a higher risk of recurrent thrombosis instead of when anticoagulation was continued. But this should be balanced, of course, against the risk of bleeding, which was higher in patients who continued anticoagulation.
It is sad to say, but I think that we won't never ever have reliable evidences on this specific topic. So I think that what proposed is a wise decision. And also here in Italy, in my practice, it is an internal medicine job, this one.
So now it's time to switch topics again. We are now moving into vascular kidney disease, starting with renal artery stenosis. This is a completely new section in the 2025 guideline, so all the recommendations are new. We could easily dedicate an entire episode to this topic, and we just might in the future, but for now I've selected the most relevant recommendations for clinical practice to discuss today's podcast. Recommendation 63, class 3A, level A, states that percutaneous transluminal renal artery angioplasty with or without stenting is not indicated in patients with any degree of renal artery stenosis and controlled hypertension and renal function. In clinical practice, how do you decide when a patient moves from conservative management to being a true candidate for revascularization? And who usually takes the lead in managing these patients conservatively? Is that typically within the vascular surgeon's domain, or are they more often referred and followed by nephrologists or other specialists?
It was interesting to learn that actually since the 90s, where the trials were performed comparing medical therapy against renal artery stenting, there's no new information. The renal part of these guidelines is new as part of these guidelines, but they used to be in the peripheral artery guidelines, and the guideline steering committee decided to include it in the mesenteric and renal artery and venous guidelines. But it was interesting to read that there is no new evidence since the 90s, and all the trials comparing stenting versus medical therapy were negative, so they did not confer any benefit of intervention over medical therapy. With us, it's the vascular internist, the vascular medicine department, who takes care of patients with hypertension. It's a matter of taste whether you should proceed to renal artery angioplasty. And you may consider this when a patient is on 3-4 antihypertensive drugs, which can be very invalidating, incapacitating. And then you can consider doing an angioplasty in order to reduce the number of antihypertensives in order to improve your quality of life. It's not a strong recommendation to do this, but you can consider treating patients with angioplasty. And the same actually applies to renal function. And with us, that's more in the field of the nephrologist indeed and the vascular medicine as well.
Let's now turn to patients who do have an indication for revascularization, starting with fibromuscular dysplasia or FMD. FMD is an idiopathic, segmental, non-atherosclerotic and non-inflammatory disease affecting the muscular layer of arterial walls. It leads to stenosis of small and medium-sized arteries and accounts for roughly 10% of renal artery stenosis cases with a clear femoral predominance. Recommendation 64, class 2A, level C, states that percutaneous transluminal renal artery angioplasty with bile outstenting should be considered for patients with resistant hypertension despite taking three or more antihypertensive drugs and a renal artery stenosis of more than 70% due to fibromuscular dysplasia. Why is stenting not routinely performed in FMD, and in which situations would you consider placing a stent?
Again, we are moving for a quite rare disease. FMD is, I think, a different beast compared to atherosclerotic stenosis. If we rely on evidence, we can see that a simple PTA, it is quite effective in these patients and yields excellent long-term results. So stenting is not routinely performed, and it is reserved to as a bailout strategy. And this is driven by two main pillars: high success rate with simple PTA and the risk of complications coming from stenting. Because, of course, every time we put metallic stents in these specific arteries that are not atherosclerotic vessels, this is associated with higher risk of complication in the long term.
What kind of complications do you foresee, Nicola?
I think that these patients are at a higher risk of dissection. And of course, when you start putting a stent and then you have a dissection and then you need probably a second stent. And of course, all the time we do additional maneuver, we can face additional complications. This is the main complication that I foresee.
Recommendation 66, class 2A, level C, states that percutaneous transluminal renal artery angioplasty with stenting should be considered for selected patients with resistant hypertension despite taking three or more antihypertensive drugs and an atherosclerotic renal artery stenosis of more than 70%. What is the success rate of renal artery stenting in controlling resistant hypertension, and what is your approach to post-procedural antithrombotic therapy and follow-up in these patients?
I would cite the one registry, which is the Hercules study, and there were about 200 patients who had more than three antihypertensive drugs and a renal artery stenosis. And they were treated with renal artery stenting. And it was interesting to learn that there was a reduction indeed in systolic blood pressure, which was about 10 mils of mercury. So this might be significant. But they still had the same number of antihypertensive drugs as before the interventions. It's not sure whether this would help you to get rid of some of the drugs that you need to take. And it's also interesting to know that there was no effect on renal function. So there's not very hard evidence that it's useful, but you may consider this.
There are two large randomized controlled trials, the Astral and the Coral trial, both including above the 800 patients. They were randomly allocated to PTA plus optimal medical treatment or optimal medical treatment alone. Again, there were no significant difference in the primary and secondary endpoints, including blood pressure, progressive renal insufficiency, cardiovascular events, and deaths. And this was also substantiated by a systematic review published in 2021, summarizing that the only occasion for invasive treatment of renal artery stenosis is a rapid deterioration in kidney function in patients with a clear and limited bilateral stenosis at the origin of the renal arteries and with remaining kidney parenchyma.
Another new section in this guideline covers nutcracker syndrome, a rare condition caused by external compression of the left renal vein, either between the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery, known as anterior nutcracker syndrome, or between the aorta and the vertebral column, posterior nutcracker syndrome. This compression results in dilatation of the left renal vein and increased venous pressure, leading to venous hypertension. Patients may present with microscopic or macroscopic hematuria, flank, abdominal, or pelvic pain, proteinuria, as well as dyspareunia, dysmenorrhea, orthostatic hypertension, and fatigue. How is the diagnosis of nutcracker syndrome established in clinical practice?
I think you just mentioned all the signs and symptoms, so I'm not going to repeat them. You may add some imaging, and for this you can use a duplex ultrasonography, which shows compression of the renal vein, or make a CTA to confirm that there's compression of the renal vein.
I think that The challenging part of diagnosis and eventually treating these patients is that if you have macroscopic hematuria and other symptoms, it is quite clear that the patient is symptomatic. But when you have some mild flank pain, mild discomfort, it is very difficult to establish the diagnosis because we have on one hand the radiological diagnosis and on the other hand the clinical diagnosis. I think that sometimes it is very difficult to match these two diagnoses. Basically, what we do here is that unless we have macroscopic hematuria or proteinuria, or at least we have some lab results, usually we treat this patient conservatively.
When we are talking about treatment, there are three new recommendations on this topic. Recommendation 69 to 71, for patients with mild symptoms, conservative management is recommended. As you just said, this is class 1 level C evidence. And open surgical treatment, typically by left renal vein transposition, should be considered for those with a confirmed diagnosis who experience severe symptoms, class 2A level C. And finally, endovascular stenting may be considered for selected patients with severe symptoms, class 2B level C. In your clinical practice, how do you decide when a patient's symptoms are severe enough to warrant intervention rather than conservative management? And once that decision is made, how do you choose between an open surgical approach and an endovascular one? What are the key factors that guide that choice?
I think the audience should be aware that the only class 1 recommendation in this domain is that conservative management is recommended for patients with an established diagnosis of nutcracker syndrome who have mild symptoms. So that means doing nothing and talk to your patients and explain their symptoms is in most cases enough. And that is in line with the other three compression syndromes in the abdomen, the Mals, the Wilkie, and the May Turner. If they have mild symptoms, only talk to them, sometimes every year, but it helps. Paraphrasing Cilacci, his 1972 statement about Mals, it's also valid, in my opinion, for Nutcracker. No patient had ever been proven on scientific grounds to have an abnormality of visceral structures or function that was caused by extraluminal compression of the left renal vein between the SMA and the aorta, or supposed relief from the intervention could be anything else than a placebo effect. There is really no support. However, personally, I believe in the diagnosis in very, very selected cases. And in these cases, we prefer left renal vein reimplantation downstream in the inferior caval vein. We do not perform, in my institute, stenting of the left renal vein. We observed a few displacements, and we also observed in one case that the stent was in the pulmonary artery. If you have severe symptoms, then it's a relatively easy intervention for an experienced vascular surgeon to reimplant left renal vein downstream in the inferior caval vein. Maybe if you do something, in my opinion, that should be a class 3B recommendation. Don't harm your patient. But that's my personal experience.
As we discussed in the second chapter, that diagnosis and treatment of MALS provoked many emotions among the members of the writing committee, the reviewers, and also the guideline steering committee. We had extensive discussions as to whether we should include MALS and also about the grading of the recommendations. The interesting thing is the number of publications on Nutcracker syndrome are even less than on MALS, and the reviewers and the steering committee were much more easygoing with the recommendations for Nutcracker syndrome. That was really striking. Their opinion was, as ours, to treat patients conservatively, and only do anything in case of severe symptoms. And then it was quite easy to issue recommendations about surgery, although the results of surgery are, well, not as good as patients who had been treated for MALS. And also there is some evidence about stenting, uncontrolled studies, so not head-to-head comparisons with surgery, which, as opposed to Bob's experience, report good results for stenting. But it is quite obvious for everyone that surgery should be the treatment of choice. So we follow this after extensive discussions. But the thing that I remember is this are the extensive discussions about MALS, and then for Nutcracker syndrome, we would be easygoing about recommendations.
When you create such a guideline, There are a lot of topics to discuss. And if you place Nutcracker as one of the first topics you discuss, I think the recommendation will change. If you discuss this after 2 days of really deep discussions, everybody says, okay, there is no evidence. What do you think? I agree. And that's also how it works. And if you really change the guideline or committee, I think in malls, but also in Nutcracker, the recommendation can also be changed.
Yeah, but the good thing is that there are external reviewers and also the steering committee, so we're not the only ones to decide what's coming into the guideline about the grading as well. And then it really struck me how easy all our colleagues were about the recommendations about Nutcracker, for which there's even less evidence than for malls.
Well, let's continue. Chapter 9 is solely focused on visceral artery aneurysms, rare vascular abnormalities, often discovered incidentally thanks to modern imaging. Although most remain stable, their rupture can be catastrophic. Diagnosis is best made with CT angiography, and treatment decisions depend on symptoms, aneurysm size, and location. Urgent repair is indicated for symptomatic or mycotic aneurysms, while endovascular repair is now preferred over open surgery when anatomy allows. For small asymptomatic aneurysms, typically below 30 millimeters or 50 millimeters for pancreaticoduodenal arteries, regular imaging follow-up is recommended. In women who are pregnant or of childbearing age, even small splenic or renal artery aneurysms should be treated due to the high risk of rupture. So the key question is, how do we find the right balance between avoiding unnecessary interventions and preventing life-threatening rupture, especially in young or pregnant patients?
I think it's a key point of discussion, this one. Of course, we need to find a balance. We need to avoid unnecessary intervention. And I think that this is mainly made on size threshold. But when you look at these guidelines and you compare these guidelines with the American one, you can see that there's a huge heterogeneity in the threshold for elective repair. And unfortunately, this comes by the lack of true reliable evidence. And also, as we said before, it is a matter of committee discussion. But when we discussed this threshold within the committee, we looked at the largest publications on the topic. When you look at this publication, you can see that most aneurysms are greater than 3 centimeters at elective treatment. And this is the threshold for basically all the visceral vessels, with one exception, that is pancreatico and gastroduodenal arteries. For these arteries, we choose the 1.5 centimeter threshold. And also, this comes from one publication, the largest one from the US, that showed that the diameter at repair of these lesions was greater than 2 centimeters. And this means that ruptured aneurysms usually are greater than 2 centimeters. And that's why we choose 1.5 threshold. So this is true for elective repair. When we come to urgent repair, I think that the undisputable indication it is ruptured aneurysms. We can talk about symptomatic one. And even in this case, when you ruled out all other possible causes, explanations, we need to think that it is the aneurysm. And so this is an indication for urgent repair. One of the most debated topic it is regarding pregnant and childbearing age patients. Here, my personal point of view, it is that in these patients, at least you have to discuss the topic with the patient, explain risks and benefits, and I think it is a shared decision. I personally won't go for straight indication to repair to all size childbearing female or all size pregnant patients. But I think it is important to discuss risk and benefit with them.
In Figure 8 of the guideline, you will find a clear overview summarizing the recommended treatment thresholds for visceral artery aneurysms. Now, moving on to Chapter 10, which focuses on the diagnosis and management of spontaneous isolated dissections of the celiac artery, superior mesenteric artery, and renal arteries. How do these patients usually present, and what is the best way to classify these dissections?
These patients can present in different ways. There can be asymptomatic patients because of a CT scan is made for a different reason, and then a dissection of the celiac artery or SMA is detected. There may be symptomatic patients, and they mostly present with pain, abdominal pain. A CT scan is made, and then the diagnosis is made. There have been several clinical classifications, but in the end, there's not so much clinical relevance as to the classification. In the end, it will not predict the outcomes, which is usually benign, because for most patients can be treated conservatively and only treat them when complications occur, such as bowel ischemia or suspicion of bowel ischemia or rupture or aneurysm formation. So you may question whether the clinical use of these classifications is really relevant.
When we talk about treatment, that is also discussed in recommendation 95 to 98. This addresses the management of isolated dissection of the visceral arteries. This guideline advises that conservative treatment, including blood pressure control, pain management, and bowel rest, should be the first-line approach for patients with asymptomatic or uncomplicated symptomatic dissections, class 1, level C, just like you just mentioned. In addition, antiplatelet therapy may be considered, class 2A, level C. For patients who do not respond to medical management and in whom bowel ischemia is suspected, endovascular revascularization is recommended, class 1, level C. In clinical practice, what criteria are used to decide when a patient with an isolated visceral artery dissection should transition from conservative management to endovascular intervention?
This is really a difficult, but on the other side, also a very easy question. I will explain why. The evidence, as Mark explained, is only anecdotal. And neither the Sakamoto nor the Jun anatomical classification can predict the clinical course of mesenteric artery dissections. So whether or not to intervene is typical a team consensus decision. Discuss it with your colleagues and observe the patient, and you have get a bad feeling in your belly and sense of unease during observation of optimal medical therapy, then maybe there's a place for an intervention. And it's important to realize that more than 80% of the patients who received optimal medical treatment did not require any further intervention during their stay on Earth. Thereafter, I don't know. So I understand that this answer offers little concrete guidance, but maybe that there is simple, is it more?
Let me challenge you, Bob. What is the optimal medical therapy for these patients?
I think we do the same as in line with aortic dissections. Lower the blood pressure. If the blood pressure is low enough that the patient has not any symptoms anymore and still has good functioning other organs, we are happy. The second treatment is that we start thrombocyte activation inhibitors. We believe that makes sense. We don't know.
And how about follow-up of these dissections? Do you need lifelong follow-up?
That's also unclear. Most of the studies who do follow-up have a horizon of, say, 2 years. And after that, the patients are probably discharged, lost to follow-up. So we don't know beyond this point. But there doesn't seem to be many changes in the diameter or aneurysm formation after a dissection of the mesenteric artery. So it might be good to study this for a longer period, and maybe we can do this in a prospective arm of the EVISAR project to gather more evidence on that. But probably the same as with visceral aneurysms, the course seems to be really benign.
So with this last statement, I would like to close part three of this podcast. Bob, you wanted to say something.
I would like to take this opportunity to thank all the members of the writing committee, the review committee, and also the senior editorial board of the journal for our inspiring oral and written discussion. And particularly, I want to emphasize the not to be underestimated role of Mark Hulemeyer, our chair. Mark, your dedication and the work you put in to realize this guideline was indispensable and cannot be valued enough. Thanks for that on behalf of the whole vascular community.
Thank you so much for these compliments, Bob. And it was a pleasure doing this in the end, not always. And it was a pleasure to do this podcast because we did the discussions all over again and it brought back good memories of the discussions we had.
Thank you so much for this comprehensive overview of the 2025 ESVS Clinical Practice Guidelines on the Management of Diseases of the Mesenteric and Renal Arteries and Veins. We ran through the whole guideline in these three episodes. Of course, much more information and literature can be found in the guidelines, so I would encourage everyone listening to this podcast to go through the entire document in detail. Also, there will be an international multidisciplinary symposium on June 5, 2026, titled New Perspectives on Mesenteric Ischemia in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. I will put a link to this symposium in the show notes. Thank you, Dr. Koolemaai, Dr. Geelkerke and Dr. Leone so much for sharing your time and expertise with us. It has been a pleasure and thank you again. And this goes to the whole writing committee for tremendous work, which will help all vascular surgeons and their patients. Thank you all out there for listening. Make sure to follow our socials to be in the loop of next releases. Have a great day. Bye.